All the best Bitcoin works read aloud so that you can listen. This is a Cryptoconomy Quick Read. All right, guys, welcome back to the Cryptoconomy with Guy Swan, the guy who has read more about Bitcoin than anybody else you know. That is me, Guy Swan. And we are reading another great piece today. This one is by many times read on this show author Nick Carter. If you have not listened to Nick Carter's previous stuff, it is always really insightful and really fun stuff to read. So we are diving into, because this will be a good introduction into a revisiting of Plan B's stock to flow ratio, because he wrote a new article very recently that is will take this concept a little bit further. We are reading Nick Carter's An Introduction to the Efficient Market Hypothesis for Bitcoiners, What the EMH Does and Does Not Say. So this will shed some light on a piece we're going to read very soon, and this one is really good. And if you don't know this concept, this is going to be your one-stop shop to learn all about it. So without further ado, let's jump in. An Introduction to the Efficient Market Hypothesis for Bitcoiners, What the EMH Does and Does Not Say, by Nick Carter. As we approach the Bitcoin halving due in May 2020, a heated debate has raged among Bitcoiners about whether the issuance change is being anticipated by the market or not. Those who downplay the purported impact of the issuance change tend to make references to market efficiency. This concept has thus become a source of great rancor and debate. The disagreements are often intractable, as strawman versions of the EMH are presented and the parties cannot converge on shared definitions. Mutually understood concepts are a prerequisite to a useful debate. Since the concept is widely misunderstood, I thought I'd explain it from scratch, assuming little prior financial knowledge. Origins of the EMH. The efficient market hypothesis has been attributed to several thinkers, among them Benoit Mandelbrot, Louis Bachelet, Friedrich Hayek, and Paul Samuelson. Hayek's The Use of Knowledge in Society is useful background reading for the concept, although it never makes reference to the EMH specifically. His seminal essay argues in favor of distributed, market-based economies, in contrast to centrally planned ones. The key insight: markets are information aggregation mechanisms that no central planner, no matter how skilled or well-resourced, can match. Consider the following passage. Emphasis is my own. Quote, "There is beyond question a body of very important but unorganized knowledge, which cannot possibly be called scientific in the sense of knowledge of general rules, the knowledge of the particular circumstances of time and place. It is with respect to this that practically every individual has some advantage over all others, because he possesses unique information of which beneficial use might be made, but of which use can be made only if the decisions depending on it are left to him or are made with his active cooperation." End quote. Quote, "And the shipper who earns his living from using otherwise empty or half-filled journeys of tramp steamers, or the estate agent whose whole knowledge is almost exclusively one of temporary opportunities, or the arbitrager who gains from local differences of commodity prices, are all performing eminently useful functions based on special knowledge of circumstances of the fleeting moment not known to others." End quote. In the bolded section, you can begin to see how Hayek views markets as forces that aggregate a multitude of different views and expectations into prices. Hayek understands market-derived prices as information, a particularly high signal source of information at that. The beauty of markets to Hayek is that simply by selfishly acting according to their own interests, individuals participating in the economy create signals in the form of prices. The EMH orients this perspective specifically towards financial assets, holding that investors collectively surface relevant information, which is incorporated into prices through the mechanism of trades. Following a series of studies about stock returns, like Samuelson's 1965, proof that properly anticipated prices fluctuate randomly, the EMH was finally codified for good in 1970 by legendary finance academic Eugene Fama. You may have heard of the Fama-French model. In a paper entitled Efficient Capital Markets, A Review of Theory and Empirical Work, Fama defines an efficient market as a market in which prices always fully reflect available information, end quote. If you were to stop reading here, you'd already have a better understanding of what is meant by efficient markets than the caricatures presented on Twitter. The EMH is not a mystical claim. It's simply the view that market prices reflect available information. This is why academics often refer to them as informationally efficient markets. The efficiency refers to information proliferation. What does this actually mean? It simply means that if there is new information which is relevant to the asset being traded, this information tends to be incorporated into the price of that asset with rapidity. And if there are future events which you might reasonably imagine would affect price, they tend to be incorporated into the price when known. Markets don't wait for knowable events to happen. They anticipate them. This means if a weather forecast predicts that a hurricane will emerge and wipe out sugarcane plantations next week, speculators will bid up the price of sugar today, anticipating the supply shock. Now, of course, when there are unpredictable exogenous shocks, imagine that the hurricane materialized with no warning, then price can only react in real time as the information becomes known. The speed of information incorporation is one of the tests of efficiency. While the EMH is a simple idea, it tells us a great deal about how markets operate. Markets are efficient if prices rapidly incorporate new information. Forecastable, market-moving events taking place in the future tend to be incorporated in price beforehand. Importantly, one consequence of the EMH is that once all relevant information is incorporated into price, you are left with only random fluctuations, called noise. What this means is that while asset prices will still jitter about, even in the presence of no new fundamental information, these fluctuations contain no information of their own. And lastly, the difficulty of surfacing unique new information, not already included in the price, tends to vary with the sophistication of the market participants and the liquidity of the asset. This explains why you might be able to find an edge in an obscure micro-cap stock, but probably not in predicting the price of Apple. Since Fama's paper, and thanks to popular books on the topic like Burton Malkiel's A Random Walk Down Wall Street, a heated debate has raged over whether active management is worth it. Indeed, since efficient markets posit that consistent edges are very difficult to find, many investors have come to question whether actively traded vehicles like hedge and mutual funds make sense. In the last decade, trillions of dollars have flowed out of such active stock-picking strategies and into passive vehicles, which simply seek to track the performance of the entire market or a specific sector. This is one of the most critical debates happening in finance right now, and it's mostly due to the growing realization that markets are indeed generally efficient. The EMH described. I take slight exception to the hypothesis component of the EMH. If it were up to me, I'd call it the efficient markets model, not hypothesis. This is because it doesn't really contain a hypothesis. It doesn't really make a specific testable claim about the world. As stated, the EMH posits that market prices reflect available information, which, as we've noted, is the purpose of markets in the first place. Interestingly, Fama, in his 1970 paper, calls it the efficient market model, not hypothesis. It seems he has the same intuition. I would also go as far as to consider EMH somewhat tautological. Recalling Hayek, we know that free markets measure society's net informational stance over various assets. So if we replace market prices with concentrated information outputs in the EMH construction bolded above, we get the following. Quote, concentrated information outputs reflect available information, end quote. That certainly sounds tautological, but that doesn't make the model any less useful. Conversely, it means that contesting the EMH is to question the nature of markets themselves. And indeed, most critiques of the EMH, I will cover a few later in this piece, generally cover instances where markets are not clearing, for some reason or other. So if you accept that EMH is tautological, efficient markets also starts to sound redundant. Indeed, the default state of free markets is to be efficient, because this is why we have markets. Markets compensate anyone for finding relevant information. If they weren't default efficient, then we wouldn't bother with them. Referring to it as a model makes it very clear that it's just an abstraction of the world, a description of the way markets should and generally do work, but by no means an iron law. It's just a useful way to think about markets. Let me be clear. I do not believe in the, quote, strong form of the EMH. No finance professional I know does. It is generally a straw man. The strong form holds that markets reflect all information all the time. If this were true, no hedge funds or active managers would exist. No one would bother poring over Apple's quarterly reports or evaluating the prospects for oil discovery in the Permian Basin. Clearly, given that we have a large active asset management industry in which lots of very bright individuals constantly seek to surface new information about various assets, the strong form doesn't hold. Truthfully, the EMH is not something you believe in or not. The choice is to understand markets as useful information discovery mechanisms or reject the usefulness of markets altogether. There are a couple of conditions which lead to market inefficiency. Fama acknowledges as much in his 1970 paper, calling out transaction costs, the cost of acquiring relevant information, and disagreement among investors as potential impairments to market efficiency. I'll discuss two here, the cost of surfacing material information and frictions inherent in actually expressing market views. If the EMH generally holds, how are funds compensated for finding information? So what explains the fact that there is a large, albeit shrinking, industry involved in active investing, despite the fact that markets are generally efficient? If market-relevant information is generally encoded in prices, then there is no profit from finding new information and trading against it. But clearly, many individuals and firms do actively attempt to surface new information. This presents a bit of a paradox. This brings us to another one of my favorite papers, On the Impossibility of Efficient Markets by Grossman and Stiglitz. The authors point out that gathering information is costly, not free. They then note that since EMH posits that all information is immediately expressed in prices, there would be no compensation for incurring costs to surface new information under that model. Thus, markets cannot be perfectly efficient. Information asymmetries must exist, as there must be a way to compensate informed traders. Their model introduces the useful variable of information cost into the standard model of market efficiency. It follows from their model that if information becomes more costly, markets become less efficient, and vice versa. So whether or not markets reflect their fundamentals is at least partially a function of the difficulty of surfacing that relevant information. The authors conclude, quote, "We have argued that because information is costly, prices cannot perfectly reflect the information which is available, since if it did, those who spent resources to obtain it would receive no compensation. There is a fundamental conflict between the efficiency with which markets spread information and the incentives to acquire information." End quote. A rather delightful implication of Grossman and Stiglitz is that to render arbitraging prices back to where they, quote, should be a profitable activity, there has to be a cohort of traders who are perennially knocking prices out of whack. Fisher Black, he of the Black-Scholes formula, gives us an answer with a lovely paper pithily entitled Noise in the Journal of Finance. He identifies unsophisticated noise traders, those who trade on noise rather than information. Noise can be found anywhere. Just mosey on to TradingView and see the plethora of indicators that people swear by. Black divides market players into two cohorts. Quote, "People who trade on noise are willing to trade even though, from an objective point of view, they would be better off not trading. Perhaps they think the noise they are trading on is information, or perhaps they just like to trade. With a lot of noise traders in the market, it now pays for those with information to trade. Most of the time, the noise traders as a group will lose money by trading, while information traders as a group will make money." End quote. Noise, in Black's view, makes financial markets possible. The existence of noise traders gives professional firms like hedge funds liquidity and valuable counterparts to trade against. In the poker analogy, noise traders are the fish. They make the game profitable for the sharks, even in the presence of a rake. Ask any former online poker player. As the scene became more competitive and unsophisticated players left, it stopped being as profitable to play. The noise theory resolves the apparent impossibility of efficient markets, as pointed out by Grossman and Stiglitz. The existence of noise as introduced by unsophisticated traders gives sophisticated traders a considerable financial incentive to introduce information into prices. So you can thank the degenerates overtrading on BitMEX. They are the ones compensating funds for allocating resources to Bitcoin and surfacing relevant information quickly. If the EMH generally holds, how do you explain instances where markets do not clear? This is another good question. There are copious examples of situations where arbitrage opportunities were easy to identify, yet where the arbitrage could not be closed for some reason. The most famous of these examples is arguably the trade which caused the demise of long-term capital management, or LTCM. It was a pair trade on bonds which were effectively identical, but were differently priced, partially due to the Russian default in 1998. LTCM was betting that the prices of the bonds would converge. However, many other hedge funds had made that same bet with leverage, and as the bonds failed to converge in a timely manner, LPs in some of the hedge funds redeemed. The funds faced margin calls, and thus were forced to liquidate their positions. This kicked off a feedback loop, causing additional squeezes. The cheaper bonds were sold off, and the pricier instruments kept rallying as shorts were covered. LTCM was betting on market efficiency and the convergence of these instruments, but because of market stress and the winding down of pent-up leverage, they weren't able to complete the trade and the fund blew up. This phenomenon is examined in a 1997 paper from Schleifer and Vishny, entitled The Limits of Arbitrage. Schleifer and Vishny point out that arbitrage is not normally done by the market generically, but rather is a task delegated to specialized institutions, funds typically. As such, arbitrage is costly, requiring freely available capital. There's a paradox. Great arbitrage opportunities come about when the market is under stress. This is when you get many stocks trading at a low price to book, for instance. But during times of market stress, capital is least available. Thus, the arbitragers, who require capital to operate, are worst equipped to perform the required arbitrage when they are most needed. These are the limits of arbitrage, as the authors state. Quote, When arbitrage requires capital, arbitragers can become most constrained when they have the best opportunities, i.e., when the mispricing they have bet against gets even worse. Moreover, the fear of this scenario would make them more cautious when they put on their initial trades, and hence less effective in bringing about market efficiency. End quote. Take the simple example of a value-based hedge fund which has raised outside capital. They will tell LPs, investors in the hedge fund, of their intention to pursue contrarian bets, buying value stocks when they are cheap, for instance. Let's say the market declines and they buy a basket of stocks whose valuations have contracted and have low PE ratios. However, imagine that the market subsequently declines another 40%. Their LPs are now staring at a loss and ask to redeem. This is the worst possible time. The fund has to sell the stocks at a loss, even if they have a high conviction on making money in the long term. They would much rather be buying the now very discounted stocks, whose valuations are even more attractive. To make things worse, liquidating those positions forces them down further, punishing other funds making the same trade. Schleifer and Vishny therefore find that, quote, "Performance-based arbitrage is particularly ineffective in extreme circumstances, where prices are significantly out of line and arbitragers are fully invested. In these circumstances, arbitragers might bail out of the market when their participation is most needed." End quote. The limits to arbitrage caveat about EMH actually explains a lot of situations where people will describe market conditions and lament that information is not being incorporated. This is often taken as a slight against the EMH, but of course we cannot expect malfunctioning markets to operate properly. So when DentaCoin's multi-billion dollar putative market cap is touted as an example of market efficiency not holding, consider that it likely had a minuscule float, ownership was extremely concentrated, and obtaining a borrow for a short was impossible. This means that market participants cannot meaningfully express their views on the asset. A fuller conception. Mindful of these constraints, issues of market structure, costly information, limits to arbitrage, we can devise a more complete version of the EMH which includes these caveats. You might therefore devise a modified EMH that sounds a bit like this. Quote, "Free markets reflect available information to the extent that price-setting entities are willing and mechanically able to act upon it." End quote. Free markets, because state-controlled markets may not clear. For instance, markets for currencies with capital controls do not give reliable signals, since selling is effectively constrained. Price-setting entities, because minnows don't ultimately matter most of the time. A small number of well-capitalized participants can suffice to incorporate material information into price. To the extent that they are willing. This covers the costly information caveat. If information is more costly to obtain than it is worth to instrumentalize, for instance in the case of discovering accounting fraud in a microcap stock, then it won't be included in the price. Mechanically able. This covers cases where limits to arbitrage exist. If there is a liquidity crisis, or the markets are not functioning properly, for whatever reason, and funds cannot operationalize their views on the market, inefficiency may occur. So when most financial professionals talk about the EMH, they generally imply a modified, slightly caveated version like the one above. Almost never do they mean the strong form of the EMH. Interestingly, by caveating the EMH, we have stumbled on an alternative conception entirely. The model I have described here somewhat resembles Andrew Lowe's adaptive market hypothesis. Indeed, while I am very happy to maintain that most liquid markets are efficient most of the time, the adaptive market model far more closely captures my views on the markets than any of the generic EMH formulations. Many active managers that I know are at least familiar with Lowe's work. The theory is fully developed in his book, but you can get a condensed version in his 2004 paper. In short, Lowe attempts to harmonize findings from behavioral economics, finding apparent irrationality on the part of investors, with the orthodox EMH school. He calls it the adaptive market hypothesis because he relies on an evolutionary approach to markets. Taking Black's insight further, Lowe divides market participants into species, giving us a view of market efficiency which departs from the mainstream. Quote, prices reflect as much information as dictated by the combination of environmental conditions and the number and nature of species in the economy, or, to use the appropriate biological term, the ecology. End quote. Lowe describes profit opportunities from information asymmetries as resources, leading to formulations like the following. Quote, if multiple species, or the members of a single highly populous species, are competing for rather scarce resources within a single market, that market is likely to be highly efficient, for example, the market for 10-year U.S. Treasury notes, which reflects most relevant information very quickly indeed. If, on the other hand, a small number of species are competing for rather abundant resources in a given market, that market will be less efficient, e.g., the market for oil paintings from the Italian Renaissance. End quote. The contextualism and pragmatism that Lowe's model presents aligns it with the experience of most traders, who intuitively understand that market participants are quite heterogeneous and understand the notion of table selection, borrowed from poker. I won't dive too deep into Lowe's take here, but I do recommend his book, and at the very least his paper summarizing his theory. What this means for Bitcoin and the halving. Oh man, okay, let's take a break right here, and we'll jump into our sponsor, and we will come back into the section, What This Means for Bitcoin and the Halving. What this means for Bitcoin and the halving. As we have seen, most markets are efficient most of the time. This is not something markets just happen to do, this is their purpose. I have discussed a few exceptions, the limits to arbitrage situation, non-free market situations, situations where behavioral biases apply, and situations where market participants may not be sufficiently motivated to surface relevant information. The question is, do any of these conditions apply to the Bitcoin markets? Right now, this doesn't seem to be the case. We are not in a liquidity crunch. There are no apparent limits to arbitrage. In the pre-financialized era for Bitcoin, I'd say any time before 2015, you could have convincingly made that case. There truly was no easy way for a well-capitalized entity to express a positive view on Bitcoin. But today, there is. As for free markets, Bitcoin is clearly a very free market, one of the freest on Earth, since the asset itself is highly portable and easily concealable and traded around the globe. Unlike most currencies, it is not backed or guaranteed by a sovereign, and there are no capital controls impairing selling. Participants also have the abundant ability to place large short positions on Bitcoin, so they can express a diverse set of views. So we can check the functioning markets box. Now, is Bitcoin sufficiently large for there to be a significant number of sophisticated funds devoting concerted effort to surfacing material information? At a $150 billion market cap, I think that's absolutely the case. The final test of market efficiency is whether or not market-moving information is incorporated into prices right away or with a lag. An event study covering the effect of exogenous shocks like exchange hacks or sudden regulatory shifts on price would be welcome. The only necessary conditions for efficiency for which Bitcoin still has question marks have to do with disagreement among market participants. For example, the lack of a shared valuation model that price-setting entities converge on, and the development of more financial plumbing. there are still a few classes of entity for which Bitcoin exposure is rather difficult to obtain. Of course, surmounting these challenges will render Bitcoin's prospects sunnier. So, is the halving priced in, or will it be a catalyst for appreciation? If you've read this far, you will understand that I consider it patently absurd that a change in issuance would have been overlooked by the price-setting entities. Anyone with an interest in Bitcoin has been aware of the supply trajectory from inception. Supply was encoded in the very first implementation that Satoshi released to the world in January 2009. Long-scheduled changes in the rate of issuance do not constitute new information. Any presumed demand-side reactions to the halving catalyst can also be anticipated by sophisticated funds who have a strong incentive to front-run investor optimism. Now, can Bitcoin appreciate from here onwards? Absolutely. I don't believe appreciation, if it occurs, will be due to the entirely foreseeable changes in the rate of issuance. The forthcoming halving will take us from 3.6% to 1.8% annualized issuance. But of course, I feel that there are other factors which could positively affect the price, most of which are hard to predict. Is that consistent with the EMH? Very much so. EMH permits informational shocks. For instance, imagine if we suddenly had rampant inflation in a major world currency. It's also possible that the price-setting entities are taking an overly conservative view of Bitcoin's future, or that they are acting on a weak fundamental model. These are consistent with weak-form EMH. I'll leave you with this parting thought. Regulated securities markets have structural barriers to efficiency in the form of prohibitions on insider trading. As Matt Levine likes to say, insider trading is a form of theft in which someone trades on information which does not belong to them. They have not discovered the information from public sources, but rather were privy to something like a merger discussion and acted on it. Since insider trading is banned, stock prices generally don't reflect pending catalysts like acquisitions until they are publicly announced. However, in a market for a virtual commodity like Bitcoin, insider standards don't typically apply. If a catastrophic bug is found, you can expect that this information might be incorporated into price right away. So in that sense, it's quite possible that the market for Bitcoin is more informationally efficient than markets for U.S. equity are. Common objections. I will consider some common objections here. Odds are your responses are covered. I found an instance of inefficiency. This is evidence for the inefficiency of markets generally. This is a bit like throwing a baseball in the air and claiming that its temporary departure from the Earth disproves gravity. Few or no finance practitioners believe that all markets are efficient all the time. If information is unevenly distributed, or information owners lack the means to instrumentalize their views, well, then the prices may not reflect information. Short-term instances in which markets do not apparently reflect information are just invitations to query why market participants were unable to price in relevant information. These failures aren't evidence of the weakness of the EMH, but rather reinforce its usefulness as an explanatory tool. Behavioral biases exist, so market efficiency doesn't hold. A number of persistent behavioral biases have indeed been found by researchers, and I find it plausible that they systematically affect asset prices to an extent in the medium term. However, the question here is whether they are relevant to the matter at hand, the putative effect of a change of the rate of supply on the price of the asset, and whether these purported biases can actually affect the price formation of a highly liquid $150 billion asset. You might respond, well, Bitcoiners have a bias which causes them to bid up the price of assets with sharply decreasing issuance rates, even if this information is already known. If you can prove, Kahneman and Tversky's style that this is a universal human bias which affects asset pricing and contradicts dominant market models, not only will you win the argument, but you will also likely collect a Nobel. In this situation, I'd also refer you once again to Lowe's Adaptive Markets. Efficiency is impossible in Bitcoin because there are no fundamentals. Some people hold that sentiment drives everything in crypto markets and that fundamentals do not exist. This is a convenient fallacy. There are obvious fundamentals which everyone would agree matter. Here is a short, non-exhaustive list. The quality of financial infrastructure enabling individuals to get exposure to and hold Bitcoin. In 2010, it was virtually impossible to buy Bitcoin, and your only option for custody was the Bitcoin QT Satoshi client or a homebrewed paper wallet. Today, you can get $1 billion of Bitcoin exposure, and you can self-custody it or rely on some of the world's largest asset managers and custodians. This is a fundamental change. The quality of the Bitcoin software. Compare the current version with Satoshi's first client. The protocol itself and the tooling surrounding it has been improved, refined, and made more useful. The actual stability and functionality of the system. Imagine a case where Bitcoin failed to produce blocks for a month. That would surely impair the price. If you concede this, you admit that there are fundamentals beyond mere sentiment. The number of individuals globally that are aware of and demand Bitcoin. This is adoption. This is not mere sentiment. This is a measure of which sources of capital worldwide are actively seeking exposure to Bitcoin. There are many other fundamentals which I won't cover here. Funds which trade Bitcoin seek to track the trajectory of these variables and ascertain whether Bitcoin is too richly or modestly priced relative to their growth. This is fundamental analysis. Again, if you aren't persuaded, just think about the contrast between Bitcoin's state in 2010 and its state in 2020. It's many orders of magnitude easier to acquire, use, buy, sell, and store. This is a change in fundamentals. Granted, these aren't fundamentals of the sort that apply to stocks with cash flows, but Bitcoin isn't a stock. A unit of Bitcoin is a claim on ledger space which gives you access to the particular transactional utility of the network. I'll concede that the fundamentals aren't quite as explicit as those present in a stock. But the notion of fundamentals isn't just restricted to equity or instruments with cash flows. Global macro investors consider currencies based on macro variables or assessments of political risk. Commodity traders look at production rates and the ebb and flow of supply. There are analogies here. All of this is to say that funds have meaningful, market-relevant information to trade against, not just sentiment or hype. It's just that it's hard to obtain a precise fundamental assessment of Bitcoin. Efficiency is impossible in Bitcoin because it is volatile. It's entirely possible to have volatile and efficient markets. Recall that all efficiency requires is that available information is incorporated in price. Think about the value of a call option close to expiry, with the underlying fluctuating around the strike price. 1 minute, the option is in the money. The next, it is worthless. This would be both a volatile and efficient situation. Alternatively, consider the value of Argentine government bonds in response to political turmoil. The fundamental here is the Argentine government's willingness to honor their debts. Efficiently functioning markets would continuously reevaluate the prospects for creditors being repaid. In a period of flux, the fundamental is volatile, and so too consequently is the value of the bonds. Bitcoin's volatility derives in part from market participants rapidly reassessing its prospects' growth, both in terms of pace and trajectory. Even small changes in future expectations of growth rates have significant effects on the implied present value. Indeed, in DCF models for equity valuation, the outputs are very sensitive to long-term growth rates. Market participants revise their growth expectations frequently, and expectations differ because there is no single dominant model of Bitcoin's price, giving rise to the elevated volatility, especially against the backdrop of an inelastic supply. If future expectations of growth are the fundamental, then the rapid revaluation of those expectations creates consequent volatility in price. So, volatility does not disqualify efficiency. If the EMH were true, Bitcoin would have just started life at its current valuation. This isn't how the world works. As I explained above, Bitcoin didn't start life with mature, rock-solid fundamentals like it presently has. It had to grow into its valuation. In its earliest days, there was considerable uncertainty over whether it would achieve any success whatsoever. It had to actually go through all these trials and tribulations to get to where it is today. So it wouldn't have made sense for large funds to allocate to Bitcoin on day one, although it clearly makes sense in hindsight, because they didn't know it would grow, and in many cases, because they structurally couldn't invest in it. Think about how you would have acquired Bitcoin in 2012, 2 years into its existence. You would have had to use something like Charlie Shrem's BitInstant or the already insolvent Mt. Gox, which we know now was run shambolically. You could have mined Bitcoin, but this was a difficult and deeply technical task. This returns us to the limits to arbitrage point. Many investors that wanted to buy Bitcoin from 2009 through to present day simply couldn't, due to regulatory reasons, operational risks, and a lack of functioning market infrastructure. Even if they did believe that Bitcoin would be worth north of $100 billion at some point, they wouldn't have had the ability to instrumentalize that view. Moreover, investors didn't start out with rock-solid conviction. They needed to see Bitcoin work successfully in the wild without being shut down before choosing to store wealth in it. If you believe that Bitcoin's continued success represents new information being brought to the market, then you understand that the EMH does not require it emerging from the womb fully formed at an initial greater than $100 billion valuation. Something which is influenced by Ponzi-related buying like PLUS Token cannot be efficient. I'd agree that investors in PLUS Token buying and then selling about 200,000 Bitcoin was a major driver of price action in 2019. However, this doesn't impair efficiency. If it had been known in the West that PLUS Token had all those coins and were just about to sell them off, and the price of Bitcoin did not move, then I agree, there would have been questions about efficiency. However, it wasn't until much later, after much of the coins had been sold off, that information percolated through the West about the PLUS Token Bitcoin. Remember, efficiency doesn't require that prices never move. Rather, it suggests that prices move on new information. Small cap assets pump on by the hundreds of percent on dubious news. This is evidence of market inefficiency and disproves the EMH. Again, local or temporal evidence of perceived irrationality does not invalidate the EMH. You either believe markets are good information clearing mechanisms or you do not. Granted, many of these small cap altcoin markets are very poor from a structural perspective. These assets may trade on unregulated or illiquid exchanges. This means the prices you see do not necessarily reflect reality. Thus, temporary pump and dumps in illiquid assets don't prove much in either direction, aside from the poverty of the market environment in which they trade. Generally speaking, most adherents to the EMH will concede that efficiency varies positively with the size of the asset and the sophistication of the participants. It will be very hard to find an edge in large, publicly traded stocks. Odds are, if you find some market-relevant information about Apple or Microsoft, someone else will have found it as well. But in smaller, less liquid asset classes, The returns from surfacing relevant information are far less, so there are less analysts actively inserting information into assets, meaning that opportunities may well exist. This is because large, multi-billion dollar funds simply cannot operationalize strategies trading in microcap assets. This is to simply say that there are scale effects with efficiency. Bitcoin is not a microcap. It's a globally traded asset worth over $100 billion. This ensures that there are high returns from surfacing relevant information and expressing it in the form of trades. Thus, there is a significant disanalogy between the inefficient microcap altcoins, where returns from finding information are low and markets are weak, and a mature asset with lots of analysts looking for an edge. When small-cap crypto assets get 51% attacked or suffer bad news, they don't decline. This demonstrates that crypto markets are not efficient. I'll defer to Lowe here. Seriously, read Adaptive Markets. The adaptive explanation would be that small-cap assets are generally held by hardcore believers, or better yet, closely held by confederates of the founding team. In those conditions, cartel-like behavior can easily emerge. You have likely seen these conversations on Reddit and Telegram, coin owners urging each other not to sell, especially not in the presence of bad news since the crypto community is briefly paying attention to the project. Renewed buying in the face of bad news is a way that issuers seek to blunt the effect of a negative catalyst. This only works in small markets where ownership is not widely distributed, though. Also, it's worth considering that virtually no one holds these assets because they like the underlying technology or find that particular flavor of code ripped off from Bitcoin Core or Ethereum that interesting. Small-cap crypto assets are held in expectation of a possible future pump. Thus, impairments relating to the actual protocol itself are not the fundamental. The fundamental is the issuing team's willingness to procure adoption, or at the very least, feign adoption by securing favorable press releases and partnerships. As long as the underlying protocol doesn't totally dissolve, the fundamental, the ability of the issuing team to create hype, can remain intact. Since some Bitcoiners mechanically buy Bitcoin on a regular basis, think tithing, and less new supply will exist, this will mechanically cause appreciation. This is an example of first-order thinking. The EMH lives on the second order. The key insight of the EMH to me is that any information you have, a sophisticated market participant also has. Since sophisticated market participants are strongly incentivized to find relevant information and trade against it, you can bet that they will have expressed that information the moment they acquired it. If this were indeed a plausible hypothesis, that static buying pressure would have a positive effect on price as issuance is cut in half, then these funds have already expressed this positive view in the form of a trade. This is what is meant by priced in. If something material is discovered to be due to happen tomorrow, it will be incorporated into price today. This is one of the most tricky features of the EMH, and it genuinely takes a bit of effort to get your head around it. The question then becomes not, is this information which in a vacuum would move the price? But rather, do I have information which the smartest and best-resourced hedge fund analyst does not have? If the answer is no, you can expect that this information is presently incorporated into price, to the extent that it is actually material information. Why the focus on funds? The reason is that they are specialized firms which aggressively seek out information and express it in the form of trades. They are the entities which keep price in line with the fundamental. You need to recall that you are not operating in isolation. You are operating in the digital equivalent of a jungle with predators lurking around every corner. These predators are skilled, fast, and well-resourced. In equity markets, we're talking about funds that have personal relationships with CEOs and CFOs, have dinner with them, and interpret whether they are optimistic about the next quarter. funds that have dozens of analysts crunching datasets you weren't even aware existed. They will track corporate private jet movements to suss out whether an acquisition is likely to take place. They will run a machine learning model to assess the emotional state of Jerome Powell from his eyebrow twitches as he announces Federal Reserve actions. They will take satellite data imagery from parking lots to predict whether Walmart will beat quarterly earnings guidance. Public markets are incredibly competitive. They are where some of the most talented individuals make their careers, and there's no real restriction on being able to act on information, outside of insider trading. Anyone who believes they have an edge is free to express their view in a trade. So if you feel you have information which is market relevant, like this expectation that a supply contraction would drive up the price, the most sophisticated participants have it too, and they've already evaluated it and acted on it. Additionally, you need to recall that markets are not democratic. They are weighted by capital. A whale can express a far stronger opinion than a minnow. Hedge funds simply have more capital, and they tend to have access to cheaper leverage. Then, when they develop a view on some stock, they have the means to express that view. This is how the pricing in takes place. Thus, it's really only price-setting entities that matter most of the time. Plus Token amassing 200,000 Bitcoin, around 1% of supply, and selling it was a major driver of price action in 2019. Why wouldn't the halving, affecting 1.8% of issuance, do the same? First of all, the rise and fall of Plus Token wasn't anticipated. It was genuinely new information, so much so that most investors only learned of the magnitude of the Ponzi after it was mostly done selling off. Also, as far as we can tell, the Plus Token Bitcoin wallets were liquidated over a relatively short period, about 1 to 2 months as far as I can tell. That's a lot of Bitcoin for any market to absorb. The change in issuance adds up to a decline in 1.8% annualized, but that's annualized. What it means mechanically is that 24,800 roughly fewer Bitcoin will be mined every month. That's a large number, but it's not the same as 200,000 Bitcoin being liquidated in a short period. And unlike Plus Token, the reduction is known well in advance. The halving will affect Bitcoin from the demand side by causing excitement among investors and getting press coverage. Thus, the halving will still be a positive catalyst for Bitcoin. The same logic is found in the response directly above holds here. If you look at the Litecoin case study, the price was clearly bid up in anticipation of the halving, and then it collapsed after the halving itself. This may well have been a case of investors hoping that the halving would be a positive catalyst. You can see how investors positioning themselves, making bets on how they think other investors might react, affects price. You get into a recursive game where everyone is watching everyone else and they all try and anticipate what the other is doing. Thus, even if there is a highly anticipated demand-side shock on the date of the halving, either through press coverage or simply investor ebullience, it will have been anticipated by a price-setting entity and likely incorporated into price months prior. If markets are efficient, then there's no point investing in Bitcoin. This isn't the case at all. There are some informational facets of Bitcoin which are entirely known and transparent, like the supply schedule. However, as I mentioned above, a lot of the fundamental drivers of the Bitcoin price are not easily quantifiable or even knowable. No one quite knows how many Bitcoin owners there are worldwide, for instance. If you were able to forecast these factors better than others, you will be able to find an edge. Additionally, there are plenty of unforecastable shocks which might have a positive effect on Bitcoin in the future, such as currency crises. Critics of the EMH fail to see that it only stipulates that markets express available information. Obviously, unknown future catalysts are not available. They haven't happened yet. Ultimately, if you are better at forecasting Bitcoin's growth than other price-setting entities, you might want to trade on your superior knowledge. I think this is an entirely plausible prospect, so I'm absolutely not discounting Bitcoin potentially being attractive for an active allocator, even in the presence of the EMH. Indeed, I personally have a positive outlook on Bitcoin. So clearly, I believe there is alpha in having specific domain expertise on Bitcoin. If I were a staunch, strong-form EMH believer, I wouldn't be in active management. In fact, active managers have a very strong incentive to find ways to repudiate the EMH, so it should be rather telling that I'm defending it here. For an example of what a demand-oriented fundamental model of Bitcoin might look like, here's an attempt courtesy of Bern Hobart. Link to Investing in Bitcoin, the Asset Allocator's Perspective. Under the presence of weak form EMH, fundamental analysis is possible and indeed necessary. After all, someone has to do the analysis to surface the information that ultimately is expressed in prices. This job is left to active managers. So maybe those nasty hedge fund investors are useful for something after all. Thanks to Alan Farrington and Leah Kewen for their helpful review and feedback.
Oh man, that was a lengthy piece, but what an awesome breakdown of these concepts. And this huge thank you to Nick Carter. Do not forget to follow Nick Carter on both Medium and Twitter. To stay up to date on stuff like this. And there's a really fun discussion about all this stuff. I love that he's laid out this argument kind of against the whole halving thing. And then Plan B kind of makes a defense of it and breaks it down in a piece that we're going to hit very soon. And I had never heard, when I read this piece, I had never heard of Lowe's adaptive markets theory on the idea of analogizing, kind of breaking down the concept or framing the concept of the market and the efficient market hypothesis in the context of an evolutionary mechanism, which is great because I love that view of markets anyway. I've always sort of seen markets and free markets in particular and the evolution of technology and trade and exchange as an evolutionary mechanism. So I am really excited to dive into that, but I haven't yet. So his recommendation to read it like six times in this piece has definitely convinced me to go down that rabbit hole. But this was a really, really great breakdown of the concept, and I learned a lot through reading this as well, and it's going to make me dig a lot deeper into this. And then we will read Stock to Flow, Plan Bs or 100 trillion USDs. A pushback against this conclusion of the efficient market hypothesis and what he thinks might be a bigger driver of the Bitcoin price and why. And I also really want to kind of get into this and just throw some ideas around, and maybe we'll talk about this in a solo guys take episode and why the stock to flow ratio works. So it seems to be so predictive of certain assets and commodities in the market, and what's different in a monetary market, or what could be different specifically in the Bitcoin market that we must take into account when assessing it in comparison to all other markets in the context of the efficient market hypothesis. How do we use what we learned in this piece to actually explain how Bitcoin is not simply a highly liquid, easily accessible market? As we would generally conclude it is in our current atmosphere or environment. So we will get more into this topic, but this has been an incredibly long episode because it was a very long read, and I am out of time. So we're going to go ahead and close this one here, but much more on this concept coming soon. Do not forget to subscribe to the show. This is the Crypto Economy with Guy Swan. We read all of the best and most amazing works in the Bitcoin and crypto economy space so that you can hear them, so that you can get these ideas broken down. And Nick Carter is always a great one for that one. So do not forget to drop some massive applause on this piece and share out on Twitter whether you think he's totally wrong. What's your objection? Do you think he's right? Are we priced in already and we should expect nothing to happen? Is this the breakdown of the model, et cetera, et cetera? I want to hear what you guys think, and I will catch you all tomorrow with another episode. Until then, I love you all, and thank you so much for listening. Take it easy, guys.
This podcast is a part of the C-Suite Radio Network. For more top business podcasts, visit c-suiteradio.com.